Now on Radio 4 FM, Sian Thomas reads the final part of Margaret Forster's My Life in Houses, her journey through the houses she's lived in and loved. With the children grown up, Forster and her husband, Hunter Davis, plan to spend more time in the north. But as ever, it's the London home that provides true sanctuary. And after some 50 years living there, Forster reflects on what the effect of her living in one house for so long has had not only on her, but on the house itself.
In the late 1980s, we began to think we could do something we'd long wanted to do, which was live and work half the year in the Lake District, from May to October. But we couldn't do it in our Colbeck cottage, as there was no space there for both of us to have a room to write in. One April day in 1987, we went to look at a house in the Lawton Valley, within easy reach of three lakes, Lowswater, Crummockwater and Buttermere. The house was double-fronted with a pretty porch in the centre. There were two rooms either side of the hall on the ground floor, with the kitchen looking as if it hadn't been touched since 1869. Upstairs were four bedrooms, all with long windows looking out onto Grassmoor and just a hint of the lake. The house was full of light. Before we went back, we walked round the area. There was no shop, and though there was a schoolhouse, it had long since stopped functioning as such. We were desperate to buy the house. It was to be auctioned at the Globe Inn in Cockermouth on the 7th of May. The bids came in thick and fast. Hunter and one other bidder hung on in there until finally the house became ours. There was an excitement about buying this house. It was going to be as important to our lives, we felt, as Boscastle Road had been. As Virginia Woolf put it, when she and her husband bought Monk's House, it would be as though one clapped on a solid half-globe to one's London life. But it was 6 months before the house was as we wanted it, and we were ready to begin living and working there half the year. It seemed marvellously ironic that as a girl I'd hated our old-fashioned black-leaded range, and here I was thrilled to find we had in our house fireplaces that I would be happy to black-lead myself. The woman who had lived there before us had run it as a bed-and-breakfast establishment as well as a tea place. Her teas had been famous for her cakes and tarts and scones, all of which she produced out of what seemed to me a Stone Age kitchen. She was still living locally, so I invited her to tea. She loved the room we'd made into a kitchen, exclaiming over the pine cupboards more than over the new cooker and hob. Then we had tea. "Have a piece of this cake," I said, "though I'm sure it won't be as delicious as the cakes I hear you made." She took a piece, ate half of it, thought for a moment, and then said, being a Cumbrian, "No, it isn't. But thank you, it's very nice." Arriving at Grassmoor House, what impressed me always was the atmosphere of calm. It's a quiet house looking outwards towards the high fells all around and somehow absorbing their unchanging nature. The silence inside is intense, as though the walls are noise-proofed throughout, and this makes moving around it an unhurried affair. We don't thunder around, running up and down stairs or banging doors violently, as we're inclined to do in London, always rushing, but instead take our time. On the surface, my life continues exactly as it does in Boscastle Road. Write in the mornings, walk in the afternoons, read in the evenings. But it feels quite different. In Grassmoor House, there are no interruptions. I look out on the flank of Melbrake and the rising spur of Hencombe and know nothing has changed in hundreds of years. There is no sound of traffic, only of the wind in the giant ash tree or the strangled cry of a sheep caught in a hedge. Once I got up before dawn and slipped out of the house so that by the time the sun was up I was climbing Red Pike, and stood on the summit by 9 o'clock with the sun bouncing off the lake below in a million tiny lights as it hit the water. There was the sensation, standing alone there, of being completely insubstantial, of having no place amid all this natural glory, of disappearing into the landscape. I thought how satisfying it would be, when the time came to die in such a place, just melting into the rocks. It wasn't a morbid thought at all, quite the opposite. This was our alternative life, but we always knew that however much we loved it, our real home was in Boscastle Road, and if we had to choose, there would be no contest. Often, going out to post a letter at dusk, I've left the shutters open in our living room so that on my way back I can walk on the other side of the road and peer in, as though I didn't live there at all. There are the usual shelves of books, the paintings on the walls. Our lamps are old table lamps with apricot-coloured shades, which look pretty but are hopeless for reading under, though such a lot of reading goes on. Still, standing and staring into our living room, the glow from these useless lamps is soft and pleasant. There are so many things that should be done to it, but my house, for all its deficiencies, pleases me. This is lucky, because I've no energy now to change anything about it. The relief that I used to feel coming back into our house during the time in the late 1970s, when cancer began, is even more intense now that since 2007 it is metastatic, spreading through my bones and into the lining of the right lung. Inside my house, I can cope. When everything in my body is changing as the cancer advances, my house, by staying the same, is a huge comfort, as it always has been. For a while, during several months in 2007, it took on a new role, one room within it becoming like a small hospital ward, with glass doors leading into the garden. Beside the bed I had a Zimmer frame. I never entirely lost the use of my legs, but I'd come dangerously close to it. Eventually I mastered crutches. The next stage was to leave the house to go for regular physiotherapy sessions at the Marie Curie Hospice in Hampstead. This was a big step. I didn't want to leave the house, not for anything. If I was going to force myself to do it, I wanted all the curtains and blinds of the houses in our road to be drawn, the way they used to be for a funeral when I was growing up in Carlisle. I didn't want anyone to see me staggering to the car on my crutches. It took 6 weeks for me to graduate to being a one-crutch user. After that, the crutches were replaced with a walking stick. This stubborn reluctance to leave the house still went on, though I was now able to do it. Within it, I was regaining mobility all the time, finding myself delighted to be in rooms I hadn't managed to enter for months. Lastly, I made it up another flight of stairs to the room where I write, up at the top of the house. There I sat, once more at my desk, pen in hand, ready to write again. Only I didn't. I sat and stared out over the trees. For years I'd been trained the way mothers of small children are, not to waste a moment of child-free time. And so I'd always got straight down to it, and the habit had carried on, even after there was no real need to be so concentrated. But now, I was tired. I couldn't do it. Yet each morning, the lure of the desk and the pen drew me up to that room, and I gave in to it. It wasn't even as though I thought I was turning out anything special enough to justify this regime. It was simply that for some strange reason, I wanted to be there, doing it. It is now 2013, and this is the 6th year since secondary cancer was discovered, so I am lucky not only to still be alive, but to be doing remarkably well. It is partly sheer determination that keeps me walking, but determination wouldn't in itself be enough. It's much more the effect of the controlling drugs. Soon the control will start to slip. The going is the problem. Where am I to do it, this dying? Since my house means to me what I've tried to show it does, you'd think I too will want to stay in it, to die at home. But I'm not sure that I do. I don't want to somehow taint the house by dying in it. I don't want it to become a mini-hospice, its privacy shattered. And dying at home, no matter how caring those attached to the dying person are, places a huge strain on them. I wouldn't, though, like to be leaving my house knowing I was never coming back to it. God, how awful that would be. I thought, this year, coming back to it after a brilliant summer, how much it meant to me. Suppose, while we were in the Lake District, it had been destroyed, in a fire maybe, and there was no house to come back to. What would be lost, apart from the contents? Is it the furniture, pictures, belongings which matter? Or is this love of a house a matter of what has taken place within its walls over 50 years? But this history, these memories, already have a safe place in my mind. The house might disappear, but what it has represented cannot. The building, the bricks and mortar, are not important, surely. Yet somehow the house itself, its very fabric, is of importance. An intimate knowledge of its layout, of how all the rooms are arranged and used, stimulates a weird pleasure. I know this house. It has been changed by us not only in the real practical sense of altering its appearance and internal geography, but by our living within it. Take the building away, and it is alarming to realise memories might not be enough. Something indefinable would be lost. I share Leonard Woolf's conviction that it is not nonsense to think that a house lived in for a long time by the same people reflects something of them and gives them something back. Our house has not exactly moulded me, but it has provided a structure and a privacy which have been of immeasurable value. I was not mistaken as a child to believe that having a house, never mind a room, of my own was, for me, hugely important. Coming home this year, 2013, was different from returning in other years. For the first time we had had no one living in the house, though one or other of our children had been in and out every day. This meant that everything was as I'd left it. It was as though I'd merely been out for an hour, walking on the heath. And here I was, home again. But as I went through the various rooms and began to unpack, I thought, no, it isn't as if I've just been gone an hour. Something is different. There's a stillness, a sense of caution in the air. I'm not fully accepted yet. It takes 2 days to feel that finally we fit, the house and me. And I've come full circle. As a child, I always wanted to be in other people's houses. Now, though still fascinated by those other houses, I am only really comfortable and relaxed in my own. My house is like a garment made to my exact measurements, draped around me in the way I like. I never want to change it.
Sean Thomas was reading My Life in Houses by Margaret Forster. It was abridged by Sally Marmion and produced by Justine Willett. It's the finale of Listener Week on Woman's Hour after the news in a couple of minutes. But first, here's Kirsty Lang, who will be presenting tonight's edition of Front Row.
I'll be talking to singer Annie Lennox about getting older, happier and more nostalgic about music.
I respond to music. I mean, I've noticed myself when I'm standing in a queue, if there's music in the supermarket, I'll be the one nodding my head and tapping my foot to it. It's something that I'm not even aware of. I just respond to it just like that. And so if I hear a song and it touches me really very profoundly, very deeply.
That's Annie Lennox with me, Kirsty Lang, on Front Row tonight at 7:15.